a morbid belief in love, and a fascination for the madness that love puts in its victims.
I wouldn't put quite that spin on it, Didier.
You can spin it how you will,
he replied, laughing for the first time.
But you have the love disease, Lin, and you know, in your heart, that you must help Rikram, just as I must help him.
Oh, God, I relented, lighting a beady to stave off the hunger. I'll do what I can to help. What's the plan?
Ah, it is quite complicated.
Just a minute, I said, raising my hand to interrupt him quickly. Is this scheme of yours dangerous?
Well...
And does it involve breaking the law?
Well...
I thought so. Then don't tell me until we get there. I've got enough to worry about.
D'accord. I knew that we could count on you. Alors, speaking of worry, I have a little news that may be of some help to you.
Let's have it.
The woman who made the complaint about you, the woman who put you in the prison, she is not Indian. I have learned it beyond any doubt. She is a foreigner who lives here in Bombay.
There's nothing else?
No. I regret there is nothing more. Not at this time. But I will not rest until I know all.
Thanks, Didier.
It's nothing. You are looking well, by the way. Perhaps even better than before you went to the prison.
Thanks. I'm a little heavier and a little fitter.
And a little crazier, perhaps?
I laughed, avoiding his eye, because it was true. The taxi pulled up at Marine Lines Station. Marine Lines was the first railway station after the Central City Terminus at Churchgate Depot. We climbed the pedestrian ramp and found Vikram, with several of his friends, waiting for us on the station platform.
Oh, fuck! Thank God you're here, man,
he said, pumping my hand in a frantic two-handed shake.
I thought you weren't coming.
Where is Leticia? Didier asked.
She's down the platform, yeah. She's buying a cold drink. See her there, just past the chai shop?
Ah, yes. And she knows nothing of the plan?
Not a fucking thing, man. I'm so nervous that it's not going to work, yeah? And what if she gets killed, Didier? It won't be a good look for us, man, if my proposal kills her.
Killing her would definitely be a bad start, I mused.
Don't worry. It will be okay,
Didier soothed, although he mopped his brow with a scented handkerchief as his eyes searched the empty tracks for an approaching train.
It will work. You must have faith.
That's what they said at Jonesville, yeah?
What do you want me to do, Vikram? I asked, hoping to calm him down.
Okay,
he replied, puffing as if he'd just run up a flight of steps.
Okay. First, Letty has to stand just here, facing you. Just like I'm standing now.
Uh-huh.
It has to be right here. Exactly here. We've checked it out 100 fucking times, man, and it has to be just here. Have you got that?
I think so. You're saying that she has to stand just here. Here? I teased him.
Fuck, man, this is serious.
Okay, take it easy. You want me to make Letty stand here?
Yeah, here. And your job is to get her to put the blindfold on.
The blindfold?
Yeah, she's got to wear a blindfold, Lin. It won't work without it, and she has to leave it on, even when it gets very scary.
Scary?
Yeah, that's your job. Just convince her to put the blindfold on when we give you the signal, and then convince her to keep it on, yeah? Even if she's screaming a bit.
Screaming?
Yeah. We thought about a gag, but we decided, you know, a gag might be a bit counter-fucking productive, yeah? Because she might freak out a bit with a gag. And she's going to freak out enough as it is, without using a fucking gag on her.
A gag?
Yeah, okay, here she comes. Get ready for the signal.
Hello, Len, you fat bastard,
Letty said, giving me a kiss on the cheek.
You're really beefing out, aren't you, son?
You look good too, I replied, smiling at the pleasure of seeing her.
So what's this all about, then?
She asked.
It looks like the gang's all here.
You don't know? I shrugged.
No, of course I don't. Vikram just told me we were meeting you and Didier. Hello, Didier. And here we all are. What's up? The train from Churchgate Station came into view, approaching us at a steady pace. Vikram gave me the signal, opening his eyes as widely as the muscles would allow and shaking his head. I put my hands on Letty's shoulders, gently turning her until she stood as Vikram had requested, with her back to the tracks. "Do you trust me, Letty?" I asked. She smiled up at me.
"A bit," she replied.
"Okay," I nodded. "Well, I want you to do something. It's gonna sound strange, I know, but if you don't do it, you'll never know how much Vikram loves you. How much we all love you. It's a surprise that we figured out for you. It's about love." The train slowed behind her as it entered the station. Her eyes were gleaming. A smile flickered and faded on her open lips. She was intrigued and excited. Vikram and Didier were gesturing wildly behind her back for me to hurry. The train stopped with a wheezy creak of metal triumph. "So, here it is. You have to put a blindfold on, and you have to promise us not to look until we tell you."
"Is that it?"
"Well, yeah," I shrugged. She looked at me. She stared. She smiled into my eyes. She raised her eyebrows and turned down the corners of her mouth as she considered it. Then she nodded.
"Okay," she laughed. "Let's do it."
Vikram leapt forward with the blindfold and tied it on, asking her if it was too tight. He guided her a step or two backwards toward the train and then told her to raise her arms over her head.
"Raise my arms? What, like this? If you tickle me, Vikram, you'll pay."
Some men appeared at the edge of the roof line on the train carriage. They'd been lying on the roof of the train. They leaned over and seized Letty's raised arms, lifting her slight frame effortlessly onto the roof with them. Letty shrieked, but the piercing sound was lost in the shrill of the train guard's whistle. The train began to move.
"Come on!"
Vikram shouted to me, climbing up the outside of the carriage to join her. I glanced at Didier.
"No, my friend," he shouted. "This is not for me. You go, hurry."
I jogged along beside the train and clambered up the outside of the carriage to the roof. There were a dozen men or more on the roof. Some of them were musicians. Sitting together, they cradled tublas, cymbals, flutes, and tambourines in their laps. Further along the dusty roof was a second group. Letty sat in the middle of them. She still wore the blindfold. Men held her at the shoulders, one on each arm and two from behind, to keep her safe. Vikram knelt in front of her. I heard his pleading as I crept along the roof toward them at a crouch.
"I promise you, Letty, it really is a great surprise."
"Oh, it's a friggin' surprise, all right," she shouted. "And not half as big as the surprise you're going to get when we get down from here, Vikram bloody Patel."
"Hi, Letty," I called to her. "Great view, eh? Oh, sorry, forgot about the blindfold. Well, it will be a great view when you can see it."
"This is fucking madness, Lynn," she shouted at me. "Tell these bastards to let go of me."
"That wouldn't be wise, Letty," Vikram answered. "They're hanging on to you so you don't fall, yeah? Or stand up and snag yourself on an overhead wire or something. It's really only another half a minute, I promise you. And then you'll understand what all is happening."
"I understand, don't you worry. I understand that you're a dead man, Vikram, when I get down from here. You might as well throw me off the bloody roof now, I'm telling you. If you think I..."
Vikram untied the blindfold and watched her as she looked around, taking in the perspective from the roof of the fast-moving train. Her mouth fell open and her face slowly swelled into a wide smile.
"Wow, it really is a great view."
"Look,"
Vikram commanded, turning to point along the roofs of the train carriages. There was something stretched across the tracks, much higher than the roofline of the train. It was strung between the pylon supports for the overhead electric wires. It was a huge banner, puffed like the sail of a ship in the steady breeze. There were words painted on it. As we neared the banner, the writing became clear enough to read.
The words were painted in letters as tall as a man. They filled the whole width of the billowing sheet. Letitia, I love you.
I was afraid you would stand up and hurt yourself, Vikram said. That's why those fellows were holding on to your arms.
Suddenly, the musicians struck up the chiming, thudding strains of a popular love song. Their voices soared over the blood-stirring thump of the tablas and the wail of the flute. Vikram and Letty stared at one another, their eyes holding as the train pulled into a station, stopped, and pulled out again. Halfway to the next station, we approached another banner. Vikram wrenched his eyes from hers and looked ahead. She followed his gaze. More words were written across the taut white cloth. Will you marry me? We passed beneath the pennant and out into the soft afternoon light. Letty was crying. They were both crying. Vikram threw himself forward and wrapped her in his arms. They kissed. I watched them for a moment, and then I turned away to face the musicians. They grinned at me, wagging their heads and laughing as they sang. I did a little victory dance for them as the train rocked and rumbled through the suburbs. Millions of dreams were born there, around us, every day. Millions of dreams died there and were born again. The humid air was thick with dreams everywhere in my Mumbai. My city was a steaming, sweltering hothouse garden of dreaming. And there, on that red-brown rusting metal roof, a new dream of love was born. And I thought of my family as we rushed through the humid, dreaming air. And I thought about Carla. And I danced on that steel serpent as it slithered sinuous beside the scroll and swell of the endless, imperishable sea. And although Vikram and Letty disappeared for a week after she accepted his proposal, a lightness, an optimism that was like happiness circulated in the Leopold's crowd. When he finally did return, that positive feeling greeted Vikram with real affection. Abdullah and I had just finished our training, and we teased him mercilessly for his delirious, exhausted joy. Then, while Vikram blubbered about love, we ate in hungry, purposeful silence. Didier was jubilant, crowing over the triumph of his romantic scheme, and demanding modest tributes in the form of stiff drinks from everyone we knew. I looked up from my plate of food to see a man, one of the street boys who scrounged for the black marketeers, gesturing to me in some anxiety. I left the table and walked to the footpath to speak with him.
Len, big trouble for you,
he said quickly, looking left and right nervously.
Three men, Africans, big men, very strong. They look for you. They want to kill you.
Kill me?
Yes, sure. Better you go. Go fast from Bombay for a while.
He ran off, and I lost sight of him in the crowd. Puzzled, but not worried, I returned to the table. I'd only eaten two mouthfuls when another man called me out to the street. It was Gemini George.
I think you're in a spot of bother, old chum, he said.
His tone was cheery, but his face was tense and afraid.
Uh-huh. Seems there's three bull-necked African geezers. Nigerians, I think. And they mean to do you a bit of grievous bodily harm, if you know what I mean.
Where are they?
I don't know, mate. I seen them talking with some of the street boys, but then they got in a taxi and took off. They're fucking big lads, I tell you. They fill that taxi with a bit of flesh to spare. Fairly bulging out the windows they were, know what I mean?
What's it about?
No idea, mate. They didn't say nothing what they're on about, Lynn. They're just looking for you, and they got trouble in mind. I'd watch my back and I'd watch my step, sunshine.
I reached into my pocket, but he put a hand on my wrist.
No, mate. On the house. I mean, it's not right, whatever their game is.
He sauntered off in pursuit of a passing trio of German tourists, and I walked back into the restaurant. With Gemini George's warning to support the first, I was worried. It took me longer than usual to finish my meal. Soon after, there was a third visitor. It was Prabhakar.
Lynn, he said, his expression frenzied. There is bad news.
I know, Prabhu.
Three men, African. They are wanting to beat and kill and beat you. They're asking questions everywhere. Such big fellows they are, like buffaloes. You must make a lucky escape.
It took me 5 minutes to calm him down, and even then I had to invent a mission for him. Checking for the Africans at the hotels he knew well, in order to prize him from my side. Alone again with Didier, Vikram and Abdullah, we considered my options in a lengthening silence. Vikram was the first to speak.
Okay, so we find the fuckers and break their heads, yeah?
He suggested, looking from face to face for support.
After we kill them, Abdullah added.
Vikram wagged his head from side to side in agreement.
Two things are sure, Didier said slowly. One, you must not be alone, Lin, at any time, until this is resolved.
Vikram and Abdullah nodded.
I will call Salman and Sanjay, Abdullah decided. You will not be alone, Lin, brother. And two, Didier continued. The others, whoever they are, whatever their reasons, must not remain in Bombay. They must go. One way or the other way.
We got up to pay the bill and leave. Didier stopped me when the others walked to the cashier's desk. He pulled me down into a chair beside him. Sliding a napkin from the table, he fumbled under the table's edge for a moment, and then slid a bundle across to me. It was a pistol, wrapped in the napkin. No one knew that Didier carried a gun. I was sure that I was the first to see and handle the weapon. Grasping it tightly in the napkin wrapping, I stood and joined the others as they left the restaurant. I looked back over my shoulder to see him nodding gravely, the curly black hair trembling about his face. We found them, but it took us all the day and most of the night. In the end, it was Hassan Obikwa, another Nigerian, who gave us the decisive clue. The men were tourists, completely new to the city and unknown to Obikwa. He had no precise idea of their motive. It was something to do with a drug deal. But his network of contacts had confirmed that they were determined to do me harm. Hassan's driver, Rahim, almost fully recovered from the injuries he'd suffered in prison, discovered that they were in one of the Fort Area hotels. He offered to resolve the matter. He was conscious of the debt he owed me for buying him out of Arthur Road Prison. With an earnest, almost shy expression, he offered to have the men killed, slowly and painfully, as a personal favour to me. He seemed to think that it was the least he could do under the circumstances. I refused. I had to know what it was all about, and I had to put a stop to it. Clearly disappointed, Rahim accepted the decision, and then led us to the small hotel in the fort. He waited outside with our two cars while we went inside. Salman and Sanjay remained with him, watching the street. Their brief was to stop the cops if they arrived, or slow them up long enough for us to leave the hotel. One of Abdullah's contacts smuggled us, whispering, into a room adjoining that taken by the three Africans. We pressed our ears to the connecting wall and could hear their voices clearly. They were joking and talking about trivial, unrelated things. Finally, one of them made a remark that tightened the skin on my skull and face with dread.
"He got that medal," one of them said, "around his neck. That medal is gold. I want that gold medal. I like them shoes, them boots he got," another voice said. "I want them shoes."
They went on to talk about their plan. They argued a little. One of the men was more forceful. The others agreed, at last, with his idea to follow me from Leopold's, all the way to the quiet car park beneath my apartment building, and then beat me until I was dead, and strip my body. It was bizarre, standing in the dark and listening to the details of my own murder. My stomach dropped and tightened on a curdling mix of nausea and rage. I hoped to hear some clue, some reference to a motive, but they never mentioned one. Abdullah was listening with his left ear against the thin partition, and I was listening with my right. Our eyes were only a hand's width apart. The signal to move, when I nodded my head, was a gesture so faint and subtle that it was as if our minds had spoken the message. Vikram, Abdullah and I stood outside the door to their room, with a passkey poised over the lock. We counted down. 3, 2, 1. Then I turned the key and tried the door. It wasn't locked from the inside. I stood back and kicked it open. There was a second, 3 seconds, of utter stillness, as the surprised and frightened men stared at us, their jaws gaping and their eyes bulging. Nearest to us was a tall, very solid man with a bald head and deep scars cut into his cheeks in a regular pattern. He wore a singlet and boxer shorts. Standing behind him was a slightly shorter man, who was dressed only in jockey shorts. He was bending over a waist-high dressing table, poised in the act of snorting a line of heroin. The third man was shorter still, but very thick in the chest and arms. He lay on one of the 3 beds, at the furthest corner of the room, holding a Playboy magazine in his hands. There was a strong smell in the room. It was the smell of sweat and fear. Some of it was mine. Abdullah closed the door of the room behind him, very slowly and gently, and locked it. He was wearing black. He almost always wore a black shirt and pants. Vikram was dressed in his black cowboy rig. By some chance, I too wore a black T-shirt and black trousers. We must have looked like the members of some club or gang to the goggle-eyed men in the room.
"What the fuck?" the big man bellowed.
I ran at him and rammed a fist into his mouth, but he had time to raise his hands. We grabbed at each other, fists flying, and locked in a hard grapple. Vikram sprang for the man on the bed. Abdullah closed on the man at the dresser. It was a short fight and a dirty one. There were 6 of us, 6 big men in a small room. There was nowhere to go but into each other. Abdullah finished his man quickly. I heard a frightened shriek, choked off, as Abdullah snapped a hard, straight right hand to the man's throat. From the corner of my eye, I was aware that the solid man fell back, grasping and clutching at his throat. The man on the bed jumped to his feet and kicked outward, trying to use the advantage of high ground. Abdullah and Vikram tipped the bed up, sending the man sprawling behind it. They leapt over the upturned bed and fell on him, stomping and kicking him until he stopped moving. I held the strap of the big man's singlet with my left hand and pounded at him with my right. Ignoring the blows to his head, he managed to get his hands around my neck and started to squeeze. My throat locked tight. I knew that the breath I held in me was the last until I finished him. I reached out for his face, desperately, with my right hand. My thumb found his eye. I wanted to push it into his brain, but he moved his head and the thumb slipped between the eye and the hard ridge of bone at his temple. I drove the thumb in harder and deeper until I gouged his eye from the socket, and it hung there from bloody strands. I tried to reach it, to rip it away, or to dig my thumb into the empty socket, but he pulled back to the limit of his reach. The eye hung out on his cheek, and I swung my fist at his head, trying to crush it. He was a hard man. He didn't give up. His hands squeezed tighter. My neck was strong, and the muscles were well developed, but I knew he had the strength to kill me. My hand reached, groping for the pistol in my pocket. I had to shoot him. I had to kill him. That was all right. I didn't care. The air in my lungs was spent, and my brain was exploding in Mandelbrot whirls of colored light. And I was dying, and I wanted to kill him. Vikram crashed a heavy wooden stool into the back of the big man's bald head. It's not as easy to knock a man out as it seems in the movies. It's true that a lucky hit can do it in one shot. But I've been hit with iron bars, lumps of wood, boots, and many hard fists, and I've only ever been knocked out once in my life. Vikram slammed the heavy stool into the back of the man's head 5 times, with all of his strength, before the big man buckled and fell. He was defeated and groggy. The back of his head was pulpy. I knew that his skull was fractured in several places. Somehow he was still conscious. We worked on them for 30 minutes, overcoming their initial reluctance to talk. Rahim joined us, speaking in English and their Nigerian dialect. Their passports told us who they were, Nigerian citizens on tourist visas. Other information in their wallets and luggage told us where they'd stayed in Lagos before they came to Bombay. Little by little, the story emerged. They were muscle, hitmen, sent by a gangster in Lagos to punish me for a major heroin and mandrax tablet deal that had gone wrong. The deal involved some $60,000, money that their boss in Lagos had lost in a hustle in Bombay. The hustler, whoever he was, had nominated me as the mastermind of the plan, the man responsible for ripping off the money. The hired thugs surrendered that much information, but then they balked. They didn't want to give me the man's name. They didn't want to tell me who'd set me up. They didn't want to betray him without the express permission of their Nigerian boss. We insisted, and they were persuaded. The man's name was Maurizio Belcane. I put the big man's eye back into its socket, but it stared out at a strange angle. From the way that he turned his head to look at me, I guessed that he couldn't see out of it yet, and I suspected that it would never sit correctly again. We closed the eye with tape, bandaged his head, and tidied the other men up. Then I spoke to them. These men will take you to the airport. You're going to wait in the car park. There's a plane to Lagos tomorrow morning. You're going to be on it. We're going to buy the tickets with your money. And get this straight. I had nothing to do with this. That's not your fault. It's Maurizio's. But that doesn't make me any happier about it. I'm going to fix Maurizio for lying about me. That's my business now. You can go back to your boss and tell him that Maurizio will get what's coming to him. But if you ever come back here, we'll kill you. Understand? You come back to Bombay, you die.
Yeah, you fucking understand?
Vikram shouted at them, lashing out with a kick.
You come here and fuck with Indians, you fucking fuckheads! India is finished for you. You come back here and I will personally cut off your fucking balls. Do you see my hat? You see the mark on my fucking hat? You fucking bahinchut? You put a mark on my fucking hat? You don't fuck with an Indian guy's hat. You don't fuck with Indian guys for any reason. Hat or no hat. Not ever. And especially not if they do wear a hat.
I left them and took a cab to Ulla's new apartment. She would know where Maurizio was if anyone knew. My throat was aching and I could hardly talk. The gun in my pocket was all I could think about. It swelled in my mind until it was huge, until the pattern of ridges on the handle was as large as the wail of bark on a cork tree. It was a Volta P-38, one of the best semi-automatic pistols ever made. It fired a 9mm round from an 8-shot magazine, and in my mind I saw all 8 of them punch their way into Maurizio's body. I mumbled the name, Maurizio, Maurizio, and a voice in my head, a voice that I knew very well, said, "Get rid of the gun before you see him." I knocked hard on the door of the apartment, and when Lisa opened it, I brushed past her to find Ulla sitting on a couch in the lounge room. She was crying. She looked up when I entered, and I saw that her left eye was swollen, as if she'd been hit. "Maurizio," I said, "where is he?"
"Lynn, I can't," she sobbed. "Modena."
"I'm not interested in Modena. I want Maurizio. Tell me where he is." Lisa tapped me on the arm. I turned and noticed for the first time that she had a large kitchen knife in her hand. She jerked her head toward the nearest bedroom. I looked at Ulla and then back to Lisa. She nodded at me slowly. He was hiding in a wardrobe. When I dragged him out into the room, he pleaded with me, begging me not to hurt him. I grabbed the belt at the back of his trousers and marched him to the door of the apartment. He screamed for help, and I hit him in the face with the pistol. He screamed again, and I hit him again, much harder. His lips parted, and he wanted to cry out once more, but I beat him to it, crunching the gun into the top of his head as he flinched away. He was quiet. Lisa snarled at him, brandishing the knife.
You're lucky I didn't put this in your guts, you son of a bitch. If you ever hit her again, I'll kill you.
What did he want here? I asked her.
It's all about the money. Modena's got it. Ola called Maurizio.
She stopped, shocked by the fury she saw on my face as I glared at Ola.
I know, she wasn't supposed to call anyone, but she did, and she told him about this place. She was supposed to meet them both here, tonight. But Modena didn't show. It's not her fault, Lynn. She didn't know Maurizio put you in it. He just told us about it then, a minute ago. He told us he gave your name to a couple of Nigerian thugs. He put you in it to save himself. He said he had to have the money to get away, because they'd be after him when they were finished with you. The hero was trying to beat it out of her, where Modena is, when you got here.
Where's the money? I asked Ulla.
I don't know, Lynn, she cried. Fuck the money. I didn't want it in the first place. Modena was ashamed that I was working. He doesn't understand. I rather would work on the street and keep him safe than have this crazy thing happen. He loves me. He loves me. He didn't have anything to do with you and the Nigerians, Lynn. I swear it. That was Maurizio's idea. It's been going on for weeks now. That's what I've been so scared about. And then tonight, Modena got hold of the money Maurizio stole. The money he stole from the Africans. And he hid it. He did it for me. He loves me, Lynn. Modena loves me.
She trailed off in stuttering sobs. I turned to Lisa. I'm taking him with me.
Good, she snapped.
Will you be okay?
Yeah, we're fine.
Have you got any money?
Yeah, don't worry.
I'll send Abdullah as soon as I can. Keep the doors locked, and don't let anyone in but us, okay?
You got it, she smiled. Thanks, Gilbert. That's the second time you came riding to the rescue.
Forget it.
No, I won't forget it, she said,
closing and locking the door behind us. I wish I could say that I didn't hit him. He was big enough and strong enough to defend himself, but he had no heart for fighting, and there wasn't any victory in hitting him. He didn't fight or even struggle. He whimpered and cried and begged. I wish I could say that a stern justice and a righteous revenge for the wrong that he'd done to me had curled my hands into fists and punched him. But I can't be sure. Even now, long years later, I can't be sure that the violence I did to him didn't come from something darker, deeper, and far less justifiable than angry retribution. The fact was that I'd been jealous of Maurizio for a long time. And in some part, some small but terrible part, I may have struck at his beauty and not just his treachery. On the other hand, of course, I should have killed him. When I left him, bloody and broken, near the St. George Hospital, a warning voice told me it wasn't the end of the matter. And I did hesitate, looming over his body with murder in my eyes. But I couldn't take his life. Something he'd said when he was begging me to stop beating him stayed my hand. He said that he'd named me, that he'd thrown me to the Nigerian thugs when he had to invent someone else who was responsible for his theft, because he was jealous of me. He was jealous of my confidence, my strength, and my friendships. He was jealous of me. And in his jealousy, he hated me. And in that, we weren't so different, Maurizio and I. It was still with me, all of it, the next day, when the Nigerians were gone, and I went to Leopold's, looking for Didier to return his unused gun. It was still with me, clotting my mind with anger, confused in regret, when I found Johnny Cigar waiting for me outside. It was still there as I struggled to focus and understand his words.
It's a very bad thing, he said. Anand Rao has killed Rashid this morning. He cut his throat. It's the first time, Lin.
I knew what he meant. It was the first murder in our slum. It was the first time that one slum dweller had ever killed another in the Cuff Parade slum. There were 25,000 people in those little acres, and they fought and argued and bickered all the time. But none, not one of them, had ever killed another. And in the shocked moment, I suddenly remembered Majid. He too had been murdered. I'd managed somehow to push the thought of his death away from my waking, working mind. But it had been gnawing through the screen of my composure, slowly, steadily, all the while. And it broke through then, with the news of Rashid's death. And that other murder, the slaughter, Ghani had said, of the old gold smuggler, the Mafia Don, became confused with the blood that was on Anand's hands. Anand, whose name meant happy. Anand, who'd tried to talk to me and tell me about it. Who'd come to me that day in the slum for help, and found none. I pressed my hands to my face and ran them through my hair. The street around us was as busy and colourful as ever. The crowd at Leopold's were laughing, talking and drinking, as they usually did. But something had changed in the world that Johnny and I knew. The innocence was lost, and nothing would ever be the same. I heard the words tumbling over and over in my mind. Nothing is ever going to be the same. Nothing is ever going to be the same. And a vision, the kind of postcard that fate sends you, flashed before my eyes. There was death in that vision. There was madness. There was fear. But it was blurred. I couldn't see it clearly. I couldn't see the detail. I didn't know if the death and madness were happening to me or happening around me. And in a sense, I didn't care. In too many ways of shame and angry regret, I didn't care. I blinked my eyes, cleared my swollen throat, and stepped up off the street into the music, the laughter, and the light. Part 4, Chapter 26.
The Indians are the Italians of Asia, Didier pronounced with a sage and mischievous grin. It can be said, certainly, with equal justice, that the Italians are the Indians of Europe. But you do understand me, I think. There is so much Italian in the Indians, and so much Indian in the Italians. They are both people of the Madonna. They demand a goddess, even if the religion does not provide one. Every man in both countries is a singer when he is happy, and every woman is a dancer when she walks to the shop at the corner. For them, food is music inside the body, and music is food inside the heart. The language of India and the language of Italy, they make every man a poet and make something beautiful from every banality. These are nations where love, amore, piar, makes a cavalier of a Borsellino on every corner, and makes a princess of a peasant girl, if only for the second that her eyes meet yours. It is the secret of my love for India, Lin, that my first great love was Italian.
Where were you born, Didier?
Lin, my body was born in Marseille, but my heart and my soul were born 16 years later, in Genova.
He caught the eye of a waiter and waved a hand lazily for another drink. He'd hardly taken a sip from the drink on the table in front of him, so I guessed that Didier was settling in for one of his longer discourses. It was 2 hours past noon on a cloudy Wednesday, 3 months after the night of the assassins. The first rains of the monsoon were still a week away, but there was a sense of expectancy, a tension, that tightened every heartbeat in the city. It was as if a vast army was gathering outside the city for an irresistible assault. I liked the week before monsoon. The tension and excitement I saw in others was like the involuted emotional disquiet that I felt almost all the time.
My mother was a delicate and beautiful woman, the photographs of her reveal, Didier continued.
She was only 18 years old when I was born, and not yet 20 when she died. The influenza claimed her. But there were whispers, cruel whispers, and I heard them many times, that my father had neglected her, and was too, how do they say it, tight with his money to pay doctors when she fell ill. Whatever the case, she died before I was 2 years old, and I have no memory of her. My father was a teacher of chemistry and mathematics. He was much older than my mother when he married her. By the time I started at school, my father was the headmaster. He was a brilliant man, I was told, for only a brilliant Jew could rise to the position of headmaster in a French school. The racism, the anti-Semitism, in and around Marseille at that time, so soon after the war, was like a sickness. It was a guilt that pinched at them, I think. My father was a stubborn man. It is a kind of stubbornness that permits one to become a mathematician, isn't it? Perhaps mathematics is itself a kind of stubbornness, do you think?
Maybe, I replied, smiling. I never thought about it that way, but maybe you're right.
Alors, my father returned to Marseille after the war, and returned to the very house that he had been forced to leave when the Jew-haters took control of the town. He had fought with the resistance, and he was wounded in hand-to-hand fighting with the Germans. Because of that, no one dared to challenge him. Not openly. But I am sure that his Jewish face, and his Jewish pride, and his beautiful young Jewish bride reminded the good citizens of Marseille of the thousands of French Jews who were betrayed and sent to their deaths. And it was a cold triumph for him, returning to that house he had been forced out of, and to that community that had betrayed him. And that coldness claimed his heart, I believe, when my mother died. Even his touch, when I think of it now, was cold. Even his hand, when he touched me.
He paused and took a sip from his glass, replacing it slowly and carefully in the precise circle of moisture it had left on the table in front of him.
Well then, he was a brilliant man, he continued,
raising his eyes to mine with a hastily gathered smile.
And with one exception, he was a brilliant teacher. The exception was me. I was his only failure. I had no head for science and mathematics. They were languages I could never decipher or understand. My father responded to my stupidity with a brutal temper. His cold hand, it seemed to me when I was a child, was so large that when he struck me, my whole body was shocked and bruised by the giant's hard palm and the whips of his fingers. I was afraid of him, and ashamed of my failures at school, so I played the truant very often, and fell into what the English call a bad company. I was many times in the courts, and served 2 years in the prisons for children before my 13th birthday. At 16, I left my father's house, my father's city, and my father's country, forever. By chance, I came to Genova. Have you seen it? I tell you, it is the jewel in the tiara of the Ligurian coast. And one day, on the beach at Genova, I met a man who opened my life to every good and beautiful thing that there is in the world. His name was Rinaldo. He was 48 years old then, when I was 16. His family held some ancient title, a noble line that reached to the time of Columbus. But he lived in his magnificent house on the cliffs, without the pretensions of his rank. He was a scholar, the only true Renaissance man I ever met. He taught me the secrets of antiquity, the history of art, the music of poetry, and the poetry of music. He was also a beautiful man. His hair was silver and white, like the full moon, and his very sad eyes were grey. In contrast to the brutish hands of my father, with their chilling touch, Rinaldo's hands were long, slender, warm, expressive, and he made tenderness in everything that he touched. I learned what it is to love, with all of the mind and all of the body. and I was born in his arms.
He began to cough and attempted to clear his throat, but the cough became a fit that racked his body in painful spasms.
You've got to stop smoking and drinking so much, Didier. And you've got to do a little exercise now and then.
Oh, please!
He shuddered, stubbing out a cigarette and fishing another from the pack in front of him as the coughs subsided.
There is nothing so depressing as good advice, and I will be pleased if you do not inflict it upon me. Frankly, I am shocked at you. You must know this, surely. Some years ago, I suffered such an offensively gratuitous piece of good advice that I was depressed for 6 months afterward. It was a very close call. I almost never recovered.
Sorry, I smiled. I don't know what came over me.
You are forgiven,
he sniffed, downing one glass of whiskey as the waiter brought the next. You know, I admonished him, Carla says that depression only happens to people who don't know how to be sad.
Well, she is wrong, he declared. I am an expert in the tristesse. It is the perfect, definitive human performance. There are many animals that can express their happiness, but only the human animal has the genius to express a magnificent sadness. And for me, it is something special, a daily meditation. Sadness is my one and my only art.
He pouted for a few moments, too peeved to proceed, but then raised his eyes to meet mine and laughed out loud.
Have you heard from her?
He asked. No.
But you know where she is?
No.
She has left Goa?
I asked a guy I know down there, Dashrant. He owns a restaurant on the beach where she was staying. I asked him to keep an eye on her and make sure she was okay. I called him last week, and he told me she left. He tried to talk her into staying, but she... Well, you know. Didier pursed his lips in a reflective frown. We both watched the shuffling, idling, bustling, scurrying street only 2 meters away, beyond the wide entrance to Leopold's.
Eh bien, don't worry yourself about Carla,
Didier said at last.
At the least, she is well protected.
I assumed that Didier meant she could take care of herself, and perhaps that she lived under a good and lucky sign. I was wrong. There was more to the remark than that. I should have asked him what he meant, of course. In the long years since that conversation, I've asked myself 1,000 times how different my life might have been if only I'd asked him what he meant by that remark. Instead, my head full of assumptions and my heart full of pride, I changed the subject. So, what happened?
Happened,
he asked, bewildered. What happened to you and Ronaldo in Geneva?
Ah, yes. He loved me, and I loved him, it was true. But he made an error of the judgment. He gave my love a test. He allowed me to discover the secret place where he kept a large sum of cash. I could not resist the temptation that he offered to me. I took the money and ran away. I loved him, but I took his money, and I ran away. For all his wisdom, he did not know that love cannot be tested. Honesty can be tested, and loyalty. But there is no test for love. Love goes on forever once it begins, even if we come to hate the one we love. Love goes on forever because love is born in the part of us that does not die.
Did you ever see him again?
Yes. Yes, I did. Another loop of fortune brought me back to Genova, almost 15 years later. I walked on the same boulevard of sand where he had taught me to read Rimbaud and Verlaine. And then I saw him. He was sitting with a group of men of his own age. He was more than 60 then. And they were watching 2 elderly men play chess. He wore a grey cardigan and a black velvet scarf, although the day was not cold. His hair was almost gone. That silver crown of hair, it was gone. His face was all hollow spaces, and his skin was a bad mix of bad colors,
as if he was recovering from a serious illness. Perhaps he was succumbing to it. I do not know. I walked on past him, averting my gaze, so that he should not recognize me. I even pretended a strange, stooping walk to disguise myself. At the last moment, I glanced back at him, watching as he coughed violently into a white handkerchief. There was blood, I think, staining that white handkerchief. I walked faster and faster, until I ran with the haste of a man in terror.
Once again we sat in silence, and allowed our eyes to rove the passing crowds, following a man in a blue turban in one instant, and a woman in a black mask, veil and chador the next.
You know, Lin, I have lived what many, or most, would call a wicked life. I have done things that could put me in prison, and things that in some nations could see me executed. There are many things I have done that I can say I am not proud. But there is only one act in my whole life that I can say I am truly ashamed of it. I hurried past that great man, and I had money enough and time enough and good health enough to help him. I hurried past him, not because I felt guilty about the theft of his money, and not because I was afraid of his sickness or the commitment it might cost me. I hurried past that good and brilliant man who loved me and taught me how to love, simply because he was old, because he was not beautiful anymore.
He drained his glass, examined its emptiness for a moment, and then placed it on the table as gently and attentively as if it was about to explode.
"Meld, let's drink, my friend," he cried at last.
But my hand stayed his, preventing him from summoning the waiter. "I can't, Didier. I have to meet Lisa at the Sea Rock. She asked me to ride out there and meet her. I'll have to leave now if I'm going to make it." He clenched his jaws on something. A request, perhaps. Or another confession. My hand still rested on his.
"Look, you can come if you like.
It's not a private meeting, and it's a nice ride out to Juhu." He smiled slowly, and slid his hand out from under mine. Still staring into my eyes, he raised his hand, pointing with one finger. A waiter came to the table. Without looking at him, Didier ordered another whiskey. When I paid my bill and walked out to the street, he was coughing again, hunched over one hand and clutching his glass with the other. I'd bought a bike, an Enfield Bullet, a month before. The taste of two-wheeled adrenaline that I'd experienced in Goa had nagged at me until I finally surrendered to it, and went with Abdullah to the mechanic who serviced his bike. The mechanic, a Tamil named Hussein, loved bikes, and loved Abdullah almost as much. The Enfield he sold to me was in perfect condition, and it never once let me down. Vikram was so impressed with it that he bought one from Hussein within a week. Sometimes we rode together, Abdullah, Vikram and I, our three bikes side by side, and the sun in our laughing mouths. On that afternoon when I left Didier at Leopold's, I rode slowly and gave myself time and space to think. Carla was gone from the little house on Anjana Beach. I had no idea where she might be. Ulla told me that Carla had stopped writing to her, and I had no reason to think that she was lying. So Carla was gone, and there was no way to find her. And every day I woke with a dream or a thought of her. Every night I slept with the knife of regret in my chest. My thoughts drifted to Kadirbai as I rode. He seemed well pleased with the niche role that I was playing in his mafia network. I supervised certain movements of smuggled gold through the domestic and international airports, exchanged sums of cash with agents at the five-star hotels and airline offices, and arranged to buy passports from foreigners. They were all jobs that Agora could perform more successfully and less obtrusively than an Indian. My conspicuousness was a strange and ironic form of camouflage. foreigners were stared at in India. Somewhere in the 5 or more millennia of its history, the culture had decided to dispense with the casual, nonchalant glance. By the time I came to Bombay, the eye contact ranged from an ogling gaze to a gawping, goggle-eyed glare. There was nothing malicious in it. The staring eyes that found and followed me everywhere I went were innocent, curious, and almost always friendly. And that intense scrutiny had its benefits. For the most part, people stared at what I was, not what I did. Foreigners were stared into invisibility. So I wandered in and out of travel agencies or grand hotels, airline or business offices, followed in every step by eyes that saw me, but not the crimes I committed in the service of the great Khan. I rode on past the Haji Ali Mosque, accelerating into the wide avenue of afternoon traffic. And as I rode, I asked myself why Abdelkader Khan never referred to the murder of his friend and colleague, Majid. It still nagged at me, and I wanted to ask him about it. But the one time that I'd mentioned his name, soon after the murder, Kader had looked so stricken with grief that I'd let the subject lapse. And as the days had passed into weeks, and the weeks had drifted into silent months, I'd found it impossible to drag the subject into our conversations. It was as if I was the one who was keeping secrets. And no matter how thick my mind became with thoughts of the murder, I never admitted them to him. Instead, we talked business, or we spoke of philosophy. And during the course of our long discussions, he finally answered my big question. I remembered the excitement that had refracted in his eyes, and the pride, perhaps, when I'd proved that I understood his teaching. And as I rode from Leopold's to my meeting with Lisa on that day of Didier's confession, I remembered, word by word and smile by smile, the great Khan's explanation.
And so, you understand the principle of the argument to this point?
Yes, I answered him. I'd come to his Dongri mansion that night, a week before, to give him a report on the changes I'd recommended and initiated in the passport factory run by Abdel Ghani. With Ghani's approval and support, we'd expanded the operation to include a full package of identity documents. Driver's licenses, bank accounts, credit cards, even memberships of sports clubs. Kader was delighted with the progress of those innovations, but he soon changed the subject to talk of his favourite themes, good and evil, and the purpose of life.
Perhaps you can tell it back to me, he nodded, looking into the playful fling and splash of the fountain's plumes of water.
His elbows rested on the arms of the white cane armchair, and the temples of his fingertips peaked at his lips and the neat silver-grey moustache.
Sure. You were saying that the whole universe is moving towards some ultimate complexity. This has been going on since the universe began, and physicists call it the tendency toward complexity. And anything that kicks this along and helps it is good, and anything that hinders it is evil.
Very good, Carter said,
raising one eyebrow in the smile he offered me. As was so often the case, I wasn't sure if he was expressing approval or mockery or both. It seemed, with Kader, that he never felt or expressed any one emotion without feeling something of its opposite. That might be true for all of us to some extent. But with him, with Lord Abdelkader Khan, it wasn't possible to know what he really thought or felt about you. The one and only time that I saw the whole of the truth in his eyes, on a snow-covered mountain called Sorrow's Reward, it was already too late, and I never saw it again.
And this final complexity, he added, it can be called God, or the universal spirit, or the ultimate complexity, as you please. For myself, there is no problem in calling it God. The whole universe is moving toward God, in a tendency toward the ultimate complexity that God is.
That still leaves me with the question I asked you last time. How do you decide how any one thing is good or evil?
That is true. I promised you an answer to this very good question then, young Mr. Lin, and you will have it. But first you must answer a question for me. Why is killing wrong?